Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Off this world helicopters and Tatooine sunsets. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's Mars Perseverance rover launched last week carrying a stowaway, a tiny helicopter named Ingenuity. If it works, it will be the first helicopter on another world, and engineers and scientists are eagerly awaiting the results of the test flight, calling it Mars's Wright Brothers moment. Ingenuity might be the first, but it certainly won't be the last. Work is underway on another off-planet helicopter named Dragonfly, with a plan to send it to Saturn's moon Titan in 2027. So why helicopters, and what challenges must engineers overcome to fly on another world? We'll speak with Mike Kinzel, an assistant professor in UCF's Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, who's working on the Dragonfly vehicle. Then, a space-based telescope has discovered a planet orbiting two suns. They're called circumbinary planets, and if we were on the surface, we'd see a sunset similar to the fictional home of Luke Skywalker on Tatooine. Our panel of expert scientists explain the physics of two-star systems and why they're more common in the universe than we might expect. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? But first, let's take a look at some of the space news stories making headlines. Two NASA astronauts are back on Earth after spending 2 months on the International Space Station. It was the first time NASA astronauts flew on a commercially designed and launched spacecraft. It took 19 hours for astronaut Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley to make the trip from the station to splashdown in the Gulf of Mexico. The two-month mission was a critical test of SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule, designed to ferry NASA astronauts to the ISS, ending a nearly decade-long reliance on the Russian space agency for rides to the station. Astronaut Bob Behnken.
Because there's something special about having that capability to launch and bring your own astronauts home. And we went through a lot of years without that capability. And I think we're both super, super proud to have been just a small part of the team that accomplished bringing those space flights back to the Florida coast.
SpaceX CEO and chief engineer Elon Musk was at the Johnson Space Center to welcome the two back home.
This day heralds a new age of space exploration. That's what it's all about.
Work now begins on reviewing the data ahead of the next SpaceX crew launch. Three NASA astronauts and a Japanese astronaut are slated to launch on a Crew Dragon from Kennedy Space Center later this year. Stay up to date with the latest space news. Visit our website at wmfe.org/space or give me a follow on Twitter. I'm at SpaceBrendan. Helicopters are taking over the solar system. Well, maybe not just yet, but engineers are looking at designing spacecraft other than rovers to explore other worlds. NASA's latest Mars rover is carrying a tiny helicopter named Ingenuity to the surface of Mars, and people like Mike Kinzel are working on another chopper named Dragonfly heading to Saturn's moon Titan. He's an assistant professor in UCF's Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering and joins us to talk about the challenges of flying a Mars chopper and what he hopes to learn for his mission.
I'm pretty excited to see how the helicopter flies in the context of the low-density atmosphere out in Mars. That's one of the big challenges is the atmosphere is so light and it's the sound speed is so low. It really is challenging for flight on that in that particular atmosphere. So the ability to fly there is really exciting because of those specific challenges.
And this is a milestone mission, right? This will be the first kind of helicopter design to actually fly on another world, right?
Yes. And of course, that's just a feat of itself. We've had flight in the context of entry and landing and so forth, but in the context of aerodynamic flight, with in the context of a helicopter, yes, it'll be the first.
You mentioned kind of these challenges with Ingenuity and how you're going to be looking to see how it's able to overcome these challenges. You mentioned kind of the atmosphere. How difficult was it to design Ingenuity, taking in all of these factors and all of these challenges about, you know, flight on another world? Kind of walk me through the hurdles that engineers would have to go through to get this mission to be a success.
So just to be clear, I wasn't involved in its design, but my understanding of some of the challenges that they have are very different than what we have on land. They have to worry about keeping things warm during nighttime, but at the same time, cooling things down in operation. So one of the things that's, instead of, you think of fuel limiting flight time in the context of Earth, for them, it's actually overheating because they have so much insulation that things will start overheating if they fly too long. Other challenges that they have is the sound speed on Mars is so low that their blades are actually operating at very high Mach numbers. So the speed with respect to the sound speed is much higher than what we would anticipate in the context of Earth. So that is one of the main limiting aerodynamic aspects in the context of Mars.
You mentioned a term, sound speed. What does that mean?
So the sound speed is how fast a sound wave moves through a medium. So for example, you see lightning and you know it takes one second for the thunder to travel 343 meters. So when you count the second, it gives you the distance. That corresponds to the sound speed.
Gotcha. And what does that have to do with flight?
Essentially, back in the days of Chuck Yeager, that was the main hurdle of limiting flight speed, right? It was always, how do we get to supersonic flight, flight beyond the speed or faster than the speed of sound? So when you start traveling when you're traveling lower than the speed of sound, your acoustic waves, your pressure waves move the fluid around for you. But once you hit Mach 1 or the speed of sound, your vehicle doesn't propagate information ahead of the vehicle. And you get this buildup of waves that lead to very erratic flight character as well as very high drag or very high power requirement.
Huh, that's fascinating. I did not know that. That's really cool. It seems like it is a challenge, so it will be really exciting to see if Ingenuity is able to fly on Mars when it lands there sometime next year. But another kind of helicopter mission that you are working on is Dragonfly, and it's heading to Saturn's moon Titan. Tell me a little bit about this vehicle.
So this vehicle, rather than Ingenuity, is more of a reconnaissance vehicle and so forth. This vehicle is the lander itself. It is essentially a mobile lab that moves around. It has things like drills and sensors, and it's evaluating. The whole object flies and evaluates Titan, and it's essentially investigating Titan for all the same things that you think of the Mars rovers as investigating in terms of Mars. One of the nice things about Titan is the gravity is very low. The density of the atmosphere is very high. Those two features make it very favorable to flight. The other thing that makes it favorable to flight is the Mach number, the sound speed is very high. So we don't have all these same challenges that the Ingenuity has.
Gotcha. But obviously, we don't have those conditions here on Earth for you to test out a vehicle before you try to fly it, right? We can't really modify gravity and the atmosphere too well here, or can we? I guess my question is, how do you kind of test this thing? How do you plan to design something that's going to these conditions that we've never really flown in before?
We do have some test vehicles in the context of Earth, and we're building up a whole test campaign to give us the highest confidence in its ability to fly when we get to Titan, you know, all on Earth. But the other thing that we have in our toolbox is basically computational tools, tools that better simulate some of the differences. So you can think of using, so this is kind of the part that I'm involved in, is using high fidelity computational simulations that model the aerodynamics in the context of Earth. And these things model all the details to the very local level. And then we could take these computational models and put them in the context of Titan's atmospheric conditions, gravity, and these sorts of things, and have come up with essentially high-end test beds that can extrapolate, you know, on Earth, and what we could build experiments on Earth and extrapolate them to Titan conditions. I think another thing we have going for us is that the overall flight characteristic of Titan is very suitable to flight. I mean, gravity is like 1/6 that of Earth. So it basically takes 6 times longer for things to fall in a very loose sense. And at the same time, it's very thick. The atmosphere is very thick. So it's easy to push around the air and enabling you for flight.
Gotcha. So, I mean, where are you all at with the development of this vehicle? I guess we should start with, you know, when is the target launch date, and how close are you to getting it built?
So the target launch date is somewhere in 2027. That is kind of the around when the windows open. Right now we're in a phase B, where we are looking at we actually have had some slight changes in the context of getting a larger aeroshell, so places to store this vehicle in as it's flying through space. And because of that, we're rearranging and looking at various configurations so we could have essentially the optimal design for having the longest range. So how far can we fly this vehicle for every given flight event? Being able to store all the different components. The components are really focused or really oriented around what are the scientific mission, like sensors. And then the last aspect that we have to, that we're considering, is how do we ensure that we can get the best flight performance? So you always have to, when a vehicle flies, you have to worry about, one, if it flies, and two, does it stably fly? So by stability, I mean, if you could think of a bad paper airplane, and if it's designed poorly, the thing just, it basically goes unstable, starts going into some sort of, you know, a roll and fall straight to the ground. So this is what we're making sure that, you know, if you have a good paper airplane, the thing flies nice and straight and level. That's kind of the last thing we have to worry about.
Gotcha. Now, I know you're an engineer and you're working on the engineering side of this, but I'm wondering if you can answer, a scientific question. And what's on Titan that is so interesting to scientists? Why are we going there?
I'm not going to say I'm the best person to ask for this, but part of my understanding is that it has potential, a different potential for life in these sorts of questions, right? The other, this is definitely something that the scientists, the planetary scientists.
They just told you to build a helicopter and you did it, right?
Exactly right. Yes. And it's really fun because of all the different, all the things you don't have, like gravity is very different there. Heat conditions are very different there. You know, the temperature is, you know, on the order of, 100 Kelvin. So like negative, 200 degrees Fahrenheit kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. It's very cold, very different, very different things that you have to worry about. This is what I love about working on this vehicle.
Yeah, I've got to imagine it's got to be like, you know, stepping into a video game where, like physics is different, right? There's different gravity. There's different conditions. You know, you're not designing something that has ever been designed before. That's got to be pretty groundbreaking and exciting as an engineer, right?
Exactly. It is. I mean, I've worked on different vehicles like this, but most of them have been in the context of marine vehicles, like first of a kind vehicles for military. So it's kind of cool to instead work on a first of a kind vehicle for space exploration.
Thinking back to Ingenuity now on Mars, is there anything that your team is going to be looking at or taking away from this mission? You know, if things go well, are you talking to folks who are working on Ingenuity and kind of using best practices in Dragonfly?
Yeah. We are talking to some of the people some of the designers. I think one of the things is these vehicles, they're partly the same and partly different, right? I guess some of the similarities that it has is we're both using coaxial rotors. So that means that the helicopter rotors spin in counter-rotating directions. It basically prevents the vehicle from going from spinning as the rotor spins. We are working with some of the designers and some of the engineers at some of the subcontractors that designed it, as well as NASA, in understanding some of the tools and going through some of the same practices. Some of the differences are, though, is that their challenges are much different than ours. It's almost like some of the differences are the same as if you're, you know, designing a marine vehicle versus designing an aircraft. It's that different in the complexity, and it all boils down to that subsonic or that high speed, that high Mach number flow that Ingenuity has to work with, versus we are not having to worry about that. It's, again, we're very favorable to flight conditions. So because of that, we don't have to communicate too much. I would say probably some of the more important things that we have to worry about are vibrations. So if you think about a helicopter on Earth, what you see are these little tabs at the back of them that are used to basically ensure that your helicopter is not making it helps alleviate vibrations. And being able to do this in something that you can't touch after it's been flying and through space for a long time period, I think some of the stuff on that we could certainly find useful information on. You know, did they have a problem? And if it worked, can we use the same mechanisms? If not, can we come up with different mechanisms to improve or alleviate the potential for?
And finally, Mike, you know, with Ingenuity and then Dragonfly launching in a few years, how do you envision these helicopters being used in future planetary science and exploration campaigns? Like, what's the future of helicopter exploration on other worlds?
Well, it all depends on how favorable it is, right? I think it opens up our eyes beyond something like just ground vehicles in terms of space exploration. It's pretty cool. One of the other future possibilities for Titan is to actually send a submarine there, because they have these very large methane seas. Do they send a submersible vehicle down there? That might be one avenue it opens up our eyes to, right? It's not just helicopters. It's things beyond ground vehicles.
We've been speaking with Mike Kinzel. He's an assistant professor in UCF's Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering. Mike, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Brandon.
Still to come, a double sunset might not be in a galaxy too far, far away. Are We There Yet? Is back in a minute. You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. A space-based telescope has discovered a planet orbiting two stars. They're called circumbinary planets, and if we were on the surface, we'd see a sunset similar to the fictional home of Luke Skywalker on Tatooine. Our listener Clara Sklenarova wants to know more about these planets and whether or not they might support life. So we'll put the topic to our expert panel of scientists, UCF's Addie Dove, Jim Cooney, and Josh Caldwell. Jim kicks off the conversation explaining what circumbinary planets actually are.
It's just a planet that orbits more than one star, right? So this is the kind of a first direct discovery of a planet that orbits two stars, which is a more complicated thing to do. It's a lot easier to orbit one star than it is to orbit two, but here we go.
Well, yeah, and it's, I mean, the important thing is that those two stars are together. I mean, it's not like it orbits one star and then I'll take a jaunt over to some other star and orbit that one for a while. It's orbiting two stars at the same time. It's in a system of binary stars, as most stars are. Our star being solo is a little bit unusual. And as Jim said, dynamically, that becomes really complicated because the two stars push and pull on the planet in different ways, and it can tend to make the orbit be unstable.
Mm-hmm. That's surprising to me. So a solo star system is not common?
Well, they're not exactly uncommon.
It's not entirely uncommon, but yeah, it's. I mean, something like half of the stars you see when you look up the night sky are actually binary star systems. So that means something like two-thirds or so of the stars that exist are in binary pairs, or sometimes even more, three or four.
Like the double sunset on Tatooine, correct?
Exactly. Well, there's kind of two easy ways to have a planet in a binary star system, dynamically speaking, at least. One is if the two stars are very close to each other and the planet is far away from those two stars. So you're going around those two stars, and from a great distance, they're kind of close together. So it's kind of like, gravitationally speaking, you're orbiting one. Or the two stars are very far apart, and they're orbiting each other, and the planet is close in to one of those stars. If you're doing something where the distance between the stars and the planet is comparable, then you get very complicated orbits.
Well, TESS, which is a space-based satellite that's looking for exoplanets, uncovered circumbinary planet during one of its discovery missions. This is kind of a big deal, right?
It is, because since the dynamics are complicated, it's not entirely clear what the planet formation would be like in a binary star system. Would the early stages of planet formation proceed in the usual way that they do around a solitary star? So seeing that planets are actually forming around these systems, since they're quite common, that's a pretty exciting confirmation, and goes a long way to showing that planets are indeed quite common in the galaxy.
And one of the things about it too is that it's actually really hard to find a planet in a system like this. So, right, we think about how hard it is to find planets around a single star. So you're either looking for maybe like a dip in the star's light, or you're looking for a slightly different wobble of the planet itself. And so with TESS, like, they were looking at this data and it said there were you can tell that there are two stars there. And so those stars like eclipse each other in the orbits, and they change the brightness of the light. And so when they were looking at this, they were like, okay, well, there's something else going on here. And then they thought it was maybe the stars doing something strange, but then they decided, oh, it's probably a planet. And I think it was actually the student who was looking at this was an intern and a high school student at the time. So, and he's in college now, but it's pretty exciting to be able to look at data like this when you're that young too.
Jim, I'm just wondering, you know, how common do we think the circumbinary planets are? We know these binary star systems are quite common, but can we make some guesses as to how many planets would be orbiting these systems?
We can make guesses, but we're not entirely sure. This is one reason why this discovery is kind of cool. I mean, like Josh has said, that the binary stars are extremely common in the universe, and formation of planets around them is going to be a complicated business, right? Usually planets form from a disk of material that sits around a newly formed star, but that disk can be severely disrupted if it's in the environment of another star. And so it is a very big open question about how many of these binary star systems actually do have planetary systems around them. I'm not even sure what I would say what we would expect. And so it's interesting. I mean, probably there are people smarter than me out there who do have solid expectations, but actually seeing, you know, a few of these is encouraging. And it means that, you know, probably planets are reasonably common around these things. But like Addy said, they're extremely difficult to find because you see a dimming of a system like this. There could be a zillion reasons why. I mean, it's obviously the stars pass in front of each other and the stars could be variable, and there's all kinds of things that can go on. Finding planets is challenging.
Our listener Clara asks, you know, obviously TESS is looking for signs of planets that could be habitable, Earth-like planets. Does the fact that this is a circumbinary planet or a planet within a two star system, does that change the prospects of finding signs of life or finding a planet that could harbor life? Does the fact that there are two stars in the system change anything?
Well, I mean, the fact that we can find planets around an even greater variety of star systems sort of notionally increases the amount of planets you could find, so then increases our chances of finding life on a planet, right? So I think in that way, it increases our chances. There's nothing like inherent about the two stars that would necessarily make it harder to have life. That would make it impossible to have life. But right, so our place in the solar system is a very specific place where we can have liquid water on the surface and where the temperature and lighting conditions are just right. And we have water, right? So all those things need to happen as we know it to have life as we know it. And so it's a little bit more challenging when you have two heat sources and maybe a strange orbit. It can be challenging, but definitely not prohibitive. I mean, we've all seen Star Wars, so.
And it would make for some really nice sunsets if we were to get there, right?
Yeah, I think it would really mess, you'd have a very different circadian rhythm on those planets.
This system is one in which the two stars are relatively close to each other, and the planet is orbiting that pair at a significant distance. So it is sort of like the Tatooine sunsets I think you would see there.
That was UCF scientists and hosts of the podcast Walk About the Galaxy, Addy Dove, Jim Cooney, and Josh Caldwell. You can get their podcast, Walk About the Galaxy, wherever you get this show, or visit walkaboutthegalaxy.com. If you've got a question like Clara, send it in. Our email is arewetheryet@wmfe.org. You can also interact with the show on Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Are We There Yet Podcast. Are We There Yet is a production of WMFE and WMFV. Editorial guidance this week from Matthew Petty. Our director of content is Steve Yesko. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. And until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.